Carmel said bluntly. Is that an agreement?
You've got it.
Now, what do you know about me?
Not much. You used to be the editor of the Clarion. Eugene Baylor and the other college regents were on your case. You and Eldon Strawn are friends. Marshall reviewed quickly all he had learned, which was mostly what he and Bernice had gleaned from the old Clarion articles.
Carmel nodded. Yeah, that's all true. Eldon and I are still friends. We went through basically the same thing, so that gives us a sort of comradeship. As far as the molesting of Marla Jared, Adam Jared's girl, that was a bizarre setup. I don't know who coached her or how, but somebody got that girl to say all the right words to the police. I do find it significant that the whole matter was settled so quietly. What I was supposed to have done is a felony. You don't just settle a thing like that quietly. Why did it happen, Ted? What did you do to bring it on yourself?
I got too involved. You're right about Julene and all the others. It's a secret society, a club, a whole network of people. Nobody has any secrets from anybody else. The eyes of the group are everywhere. They watch what you do, what you say, what you think, how you feel. They're working toward what they call a universal mind, the concept that sooner or later all the inhabitants of the world will make a giant evolutionary leap and meld into one global brain, one transcending consciousness.
Carmel stopped, looked at Marshall. I'm spilling it as it comes to me. Is it making sense? Marshall had to compare Harmel's spillings with what he already knew.
Every person affiliated with this exclusive network subscribes to these ideas?
Yeah. The whole thing is built around occult ideas, Eastern mysticism, cosmic consciousness. That's why they meditate and do psychic readings and try to meld their minds together.
Is this what they do in Langstrat's therapy sessions?
Yes, exactly. Every person who joins the network goes through a certain initiation process. They meet with Julene and learn to achieve altered states of consciousness, psychic powers, out-of-body experiences. The sessions could involve just one person or several, but Julene is at the core of it all, like some kind of guru, and we were all her disciples. We all became like one growing, interdependent organism, trying to become one with the universal mind.
You said something about melding your minds together?
ESP, telepathy, whatever. Your thoughts are not your own, and neither is your life. You're only one segment of the whole. Julene's highly skilled in such things. She knew my every thought. She owned me.
This part became difficult for Harmel to speak about. He grew tense, and his voice faltered and dropped in volume.
Maybe she still does. Sometimes I still hear her calling to me, moving through my brain.
Does she own all the others as well?
Carmel nodded.
Yeah, everybody owns everybody. And they won't stop until they own that whole town. I could see it coming. Anybody who gets in their way suddenly drops out of sight. That's why I'm still wondering about Edie. Ever since this whole thing started happening, I've been leery about anyone just dropping out of the picture suddenly.
What danger would Edie be to them?
Maybe she's just one more step toward taking you out. I wouldn't be surprised. They took out Eldon. They took out me. They took out Jefferson.
Who's Jefferson?
The district judge. I don't know how they did it, but suddenly he decided he wouldn't run for re-election. He sold his home, left town. No one's heard from him since.
And now Baker's in.
He's part of the network. He's owned.
So, did you know this at the time you had your little crime settled so quietly?
Carmel nodded.
He told me he could make it really rough for me, turn me over to the county prosecutor, and then it would be out of his hands. He knew good and well it was a frame-up. He had me checkmated, so I took him up on it. I got out of town.
Marshall took out a pad and pen.
Who else do you know that belongs to this bunch?
Carmel looked away.
If I tell you too much, they'll trace it back to me. You'll have to find out for yourself. All I can do is point you in the right direction. Check the mayor's office and the town council. See who's new there and who they replaced. They've had a lot of turnover lately.
Marshall made a note of it.
You've got Brumell?
Yeah, Brumell, Young, Baker.
Check the county land commissioner and the president at the independent bank and...
Harmel kept probing his memory.
The county comptroller.
I've got him on the list.
The Board of Regents at the college?
Yeah. Say, wasn't it the tiff with them that got you run out of town?
That was only part of it. I wasn't controllable anymore. I got in the way. The network took care of me before I could hurt them. But there's no way I can prove it. It doesn't matter anyway. The whole thing's too big. It's like a huge organism, a cancer that just keeps spreading. You can't go after just one part of it like the Regents and expect to kill the whole thing. It's everywhere, at every level. Are you religious?
In a limited sense, I suppose.
Well, you're going to need something to fight it. It's spiritual, Hogan. It doesn't listen to reason or to the law or to any set of morals but its own. They don't believe in any God. They are God.
Harmel paused to calm down and then took off on a different note.
I first got involved with Julene when I wanted to do a story on some of the so-called research she was doing. I was intrigued by it all, the parapsychology, the strange phenomena she was documenting. I started having these counseling sessions with her myself. I let her read and photograph my aura and my energy field. I let her probe my mind and meld our thoughts. I went into it after a novelty story, actually, but I got hooked. I couldn't tear myself away from it. After a while, I started picking up on some of the same things she was heavily involved in. I'd leave my body, go out into space, talk to my instructors.
Harmel caught himself.
Oh, man, that's right. You're never going to believe any of this stuff.
Marshall was firm, and maybe he did believe it.
Tell me anyway.
Harmel gritted his teeth and looked skyward. He fumbled, he stammered, his voice went pale.
I don't know. I don't think I can tell you. They'll find out.
Who'll find out?
The network.
We're out in the middle of nowhere, Ted.
It doesn't matter.
You used the word instructors. Who are they?
Harmel only sat there trembling, terror etched in his face.
Hogan,
he said finally,
you can't just cross them. I can't tell you. They'll know about it.
But who are they? Can you at least tell me that?
I don't even know if they're real,
Harmel muttered.
They're just there, that's all. Inner teachers, spirit guides, ascended masters, they're called all kinds of things. But anyone who follows Julene's teachings for very long invariably gets mixed up with them. They come from nowhere, they speak to you, sometimes they appear to you when you're meditating. Sometimes you visualize them yourself, but then they take on a life and personality of their own. It's not just your imagination anymore.
But what are they?
Beings, entities. Sometimes they're just like real people. Sometimes you only hear a voice. Sometimes you only feel them. Like spirits, I suppose. Julene works for them, or maybe they work for her. I don't know which way it goes. But you can't hide from them. You can't run. You can't get away with anything. They're part of the network. And the network knows everything. Controls everything. Julene controlled me. She even came between me and Gale. I'd lost my wife over this whole thing. I started to do everything Julene told me. She'd call me in the middle of the night and tell me to come over, and I'd come over. She'd tell me not to print a certain story. I wouldn't print it. She'd tell me what kind of news to cover, and I'd print it just like she said. She owned me, Hogan. She could have told me to take a gun and shoot myself, and maybe I would have done it. You gotta know her to understand what I'm saying.
Marshall remembered standing in the hallway outside Langstrat's class, wondering how he got there.
I think I understand.
But Eldon found out about the college finances, and we both checked into it, and he was right. The college was headed for the rocks, and I'm sure it still is. Eldon tried to stop it to get the whole mess straightened out. I tried to help him. Julene came after me right away and made all kinds of threats. I ended up going in two directions, following two different loyalties. It was like being torn apart inside. Maybe that's what snapped me out of it. I made up my mind I wasn't going to be controlled anymore. Not by the network, not by anyone. I was a newspaper man. I had to print it the way I saw it.
And they took care of you.
And it came as a total surprise. Well, maybe not total. When the police came to the paper and arrested me, I almost knew what it was about. It was something I could have predicted from the way Julene and the others were threatening me. They've done that sort of thing before.
For instance,
I can't help thinking the real estate offices, the tax rolls, any information you can get on the properties around the town might show something. I couldn't follow it up when I was still there, but all the recent real estate deals didn't feel quite right to me.
The real estate business wasn't feeling quite right to Bernice either. Just as she pulled up in front of Tyler and Sons Realty, she saw the owner, Albert Tyler, locking up the place and getting ready to leave. She rolled down her car window and asked him,
"Say, aren't you supposed to be open till 5?
Tyler only smiled and shrugged.
"Not on Thursdays."
Bernice could read the hours on the front door.
"But your hours say Monday through Friday, 10 to 5.
Tyler got just a little cross.
"Not on Thursdays, I said."
Bernice noticed Tyler's son, Calvin, driving his Volkswagen out from behind the building. She got out of her car and waved him down. Unwillingly, he paused and rolled down his window.
"Yep," he said.
"Aren't you people usually open on Thursday until 5?
Calvin only shrugged and made a face.
"What do I know? The old man says go home, we all go home."
He drove off. Old man Tyler was getting into his Plymouth. Bernice ran up to the car and waved to get his attention. He was really miffed by now. He rolled down his window and said gruffly,
"Lady, we're closed, and I have to get home."
"I just wanted to look through your microfiche. I need some information on some property."
He shook his head.
"Hey, I can't help you anyway. Our microfiche is broken down."
"What?"
But Tyler rolled up his window and pulled away, screeching his tires a little. Bernice shouted angrily after him,
"Did Rosemary tip you off?"
She hurried to her car. It was still the top of the town realty. She knew the owner regularly helped out with youth baseball on Thursday afternoons. Maybe the other gal who worked there wouldn't know who she was. Harmel looked grim and haggard as he said,
"They'll do you in, Hogan. They have the clout and the connections to do it. Look at me. I lost all I owned, lost my wife and family. They cleaned me out. They'll do the same to you."
Marshall wanted answers, not doomsaying.
"What do you know about some guy named Kasif?"
Harmel grimaced with fresh disgust.
"Go after that. He might be the source of all the trouble. Julene worshipped that guy. Everybody did Julene's bidding, but she did his."
"Do you know whether or not he was looking for any real estate around Ashton?"
"He was drooling over the college, I know that."
Marshall was taken aback.
"The college? Keep going."
"I never got the chance to dig after it, but there might be something there. Talk around the network said that the college would be taken over entirely by some network higher-ups, and Eugene Baylor seemed to be spending a lot of time talking money with Kasif or his reps."
"Kasif was trying to buy the college?"
"He hasn't yet, but he did end up buying everything else around town."
"Like what?"
"A lot of homes, I know, but I couldn't find out very much. Like I said, check the tax rolls or the real estate offices to see if he's been buying up anything else. I know he had the bucks to do it."
Harmel pulled a ragged manila envelope from under his jacket.
"And take this off my hands, will you?"
Marshall took the envelope.
"What is it?"
"A curse, that's what. Something happens to everyone who has it. Eldon's accountant friend, Ernie Johnson, gave it to me, and I hope Eldon told you what happened to him."
"He told me."
"It's Johnson's findings from the college accounting office."
Marshall couldn't believe his luck.
"You gotta be kidding. Did Eldon know about this?"
"No, I just came across them myself. But don't start dancing yet. You'd better get some accountant friend of your own to try to decipher it for you. It doesn't make much sense to me.
I think there's still a whole other half of it missing. It's a start. Thanks. If you want to play with theories, try this out. Kasif comes to Ashton and wants to buy everything he can get his hands on. The college is not even thinking of selling. Next thing you know, thanks to Baylor, the college gets itself in such deep financial trouble that selling may be the only way to get out of it. Suddenly, Kasif's offer isn't so far-fetched, and by now the Board of Regents is stacked with yay-sayers.
Marshall opened the envelope and leafed through the pages and pages of photocopied columns and figures.
And you couldn't find any leads in all this?
More leads you don't need. Not as much as proof. What you really need to see is who's on the other end of all those transactions.
Kasif's books, perhaps?
With all the friends and confederates he has at that college, I wouldn't be surprised if Kasif was coming back to buy the college with its own money.
That's some theory. But what would a man like that even want with a little town, or with a whole college?
Hogan, a guy with the power and bucks that guy seems to have, could take a town like Ashton and do anything he wanted with it. I think he already has, to a great extent.
How do you know?
Just check it out.
Chapter 21. Bernice was in a hurry. She was in the back room of the Top of the Town Realty, going through their microfiche files. Carla, the girl out in front, was new enough to the job and the town that she bought Bernice's little talk about being a historian from the college looking for background on Ashton. It didn't take long for Carla to give Bernice a tour of the files and a short course on how to run the viewer. When Carla left her alone, Bernice went straight for the crisscross file. This was certainly a wonderful stroke of luck. The other real estate offices had files that told you what land was owned by whom if you knew where the property was. The crisscross file told you what various people owned if you knew the names of the people. Kasif. Bernice flipped through the microfiche holder to the K's. She slipped the celluloid into the viewer and began scanning up and down, across, zigzag, the myriads of microscopic letters and figures streaking in a blur across the view screen as she looked for the right column. There. K-W, K-H, K-E, K-A. Across to the next column. Hurry it up, Bernice. She found no listing under Kasif. How are you doing? Asked Carla from up front. Oh, just fine, Bernice answered. I'm not finding much yet, but I know where to look. Well, there was still Joe's Market. She went back to the regular file and pulled out the microfiche for the section, township, and quarter for that address. Into the viewer the celluloid went, and again Bernice raced the myriads of listings up and down looking for the listing. There, the legal description of what used to be Joe's Market, now the Ashton Mercantile. It was tax-assessed at $105,900 and owned by Omni Corporation. That was all it said. Bernice went back to the crisscross file. Into the viewer went the OKOM celluloid. Up, down, across, Olson, Omer, Omni. Omni, 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 Omni. The listings under Omni Corporation went down, down, down the column. There could have been over 100. Bernice got her pen and pad and started writing furiously. The many addresses and legal descriptions meant little to her. Many of them weren't even decipherable, but she kept scribbling as fast as she could, hoping she would be able to read her own writing when she looked at it later. She abbreviated, filling page after page in her notepad. Out front, the telephone rang, as it had been doing. But this time, Carla's conversation didn't sound too happy. Her voice was hushed and serious, and she sounded very apologetic. The jig might be up, kid. Keep writing. In a moment, Carla appeared. Are you Bernice Kruger from the Clarion? She asked directly. Who's asking? Bernice said. That was dumb, but she didn't want to come right out with the truth, either. Carla looked very disturbed. Listen, you're going to have to leave right away, she said. That was your boss on the phone, right? Yes, it was, and I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't tell him I let you back here. I don't know what all this is about, and I don't know why you lied to me, but would you please just leave? He's coming over here to lock the place up, and I told him you hadn't come by. You're a doll. Well, I lied for you. Now you please lie for me. Bernice scrambled to gather up all her notes and replace the celluloids. I was never here.
I appreciate it, said Carla as Bernice raced out the door. Wow, you just about got me fired.
Andy and June Forsythe had a very nice home, a modern log house on the outskirts of town, not far from Forsythe Lumber. Tonight, Hank and Mary had gathered there for a dinner fellowship, along with many others of the remnant, as Creone, Triscoll, Seth, Kyman, and Mota sat up in the lofty rafters looking on. The angels could feel the growing power of this little cluster of praying people. The Joneses were there, as were the Colemans, the Coopers, the Harrises, some of the college students. Ron Forsythe was there, along with his girlfriend, Cynthia. A few more brand-new Christians were with him, just now getting introduced to the rest of the group. Other latecomers were continually trickling in. After dinner, the people gathered and settled around the big stone hearth in the living room, while Hank took his place on the hearth with Mary beside him. Each person began to share his background. Bill and Betty Jones had been churchgoers all their lives, but only made a serious commitment to Jesus Christ a year ago. The Lord had spoken to their hearts, and they searched him out. John and Patty Coleman had been to another church in town, but never knew much about the Bible or about Christ until coming to this church. Cecil and Miriam Cooper had always known the Lord, and they were glad to see a new flock gathering to replace the old one. "It feels a lot like replacing a flat tire," Cecil quipped. As others shared, their various backgrounds were brought out. There were different traditions and different doctrinal backgrounds, but any differences were not very important right now. All of them had one main concern, the town of Ashton.
"Oh, it's a war, all right," said Andy Forsythe. "You can't go out on those streets and not feel it. Sometimes I feel like I'm running through a shower of spears, you know."
A new couple, friends of the Coopers, Dan and Jean Corsi, spoke up. Jean said,
"I really think it's Satan out there. Just like the Bible says, just like a roaring lion trying to devour everyone."
Dan commented, "The problem is, we've all just sat to the side and let it happen. It's time we got concerned and scared and on our knees to see that the Lord does something about it."
Jean added, "Some of you know our son is having some real problems right now. We really wish you'd pray for him."
"What's his name?" someone asked.
"Bobby," Jean answered. She swallowed and went on to say, "He enrolled at the college this year, and something's really happened to him."
She had to stop, choked with emotion. Dan picked it up, and his tone was bitter. "Seems like something happens to any kid who goes off to that college. I never knew what kind of weird stuff they were really teaching over there. The rest of you should find out about it and make sure you don't let your kids get involved."
Ron Forsythe, silent up to this time, piped up,
"I know what you're talking about, man. It's in the high school, too. Kids are messing around with satanic stuff like you wouldn't believe. We used to trip out on drugs. Now it's demons."
Jean ventured through her tears.
"I know this sounds awful, but I really wonder if Bobby isn't possessed."
"I was," said Ron. "I know I was. Man, I heard voices talking to me, telling me to get some drugs or steal something. All kinds of horrible things. I never let my folks know where I was. I never came home. I'd end up sleeping in the weirdest places and with the weirdest people."
Dan muttered,
"Yeah, that's Bobby. We haven't seen him in about a week."
Jean wanted to know,
"But how did you get started in such things?"
Ron shrugged. "Hey, I was already going the wrong way. I'm not sure I'm even all the way straightened out yet. But I'll tell you, when I think I got into the satanic stuff, it's when I had my fortune told. Hey, that's when I caught it, no doubt."
Someone asked if the fortune teller was a certain woman.
"No, it was somebody else. It was at the carnival 3 years ago."
"Oh, they're all over the place," someone else moaned.
"Well, that just goes to show how far off base this town has gotten," Cecil Cooper protested. "There are more witches and fortune-tellers around here than Sunday school teachers."
"Well, we'll just see what we can do about that," said John Coleman.
Ron picked it up again.
"It's all heavy duty, man. I mean, I saw some pretty weird things when I was into that stuff. I've seen things just float around by themselves. I've read people's minds.
I even left my body once and floated around town. You just better all be good and prayed up.
Jean Corsi began to cry.
Bobby's possessed. I just know it.
Hank could see it was time to take control. Okay, people. Now, I have a real burden to pray for this town, and I know you do, too, so I think that's where the answer lies. That's the first thing we need to do. They were all ready. Many felt awkward praying out loud for the first time. Some knew how to pray loudly and confidently. Some prayed in phrases they'd learned from certain liturgies. All meant every word, however they managed to express it. The fervency slowly began to rise. The prayers became more and more earnest. Someone started a simple song of worship, and those who knew it sang, while those who didn't know it learned it. In the rafters, the angels sang along, their voices smooth and flowing like cellos and basses in a symphony. Triskall looked at Creone, smiled broadly, and flexed his arms. Creone smiled and flexed back. Kaiman took his sword and made it dance from the pivot of his wrist, tracing streaks and curls of shimmering light in the air as the blade sang with a beautiful resonance. Mota just looked toward heaven, his silken wings spreading, his arms upraised, caught up in the rapture of the song. Kate quietly set her kitchen table with one plate, one cup, and a saucer. That evening she ate by herself, hardly able to get anything down because of the emotions tightening her throat and twisting her stomach. Oh, well, it was leftovers anyway. Leftovers from those many other meals Marshall never showed up for. It was happening again. Maybe the place had nothing to do with how busy a newsman could be. Perhaps even though Marshall had moved to a small, supposedly dull town, he still had that cursed nose for news that led him on his wild hunts into all hours of the night, making a story where one didn't even exist before. Perhaps this was, after all, his first love, more than his wife, more than his daughter. Sandy. Where was she tonight? Hadn't they made this move for her sake? Now she was further away from them than ever, even though she still lived in the same house. Sean had grown into her life like a cancer, not a friend. And Kate and Marshall never did talk about it like he had promised. His mind had been totally preoccupied. He was married to that newspaper, maybe enamored by that young, attractive reporter. Kate shoved her plate away and tried to keep from crying. She couldn't start fussing and shedding tears now, not when she had to think clearly. Undoubtedly, there would be decisions to make, and she would have to make them alone. On the outskirts of Ashton, next to the railroad yard, Tal conferred with his warriors inside an old, unused water tower. Nathan was pacing back and forth, his voice echoing off the walls of the huge tank.
"I could feel it coming, Captain. The enemy is luring Hogan into a trap. There has been a dangerous shift in affection toward Kruger. His family is in grave danger."
Tal nodded his head and remained deep in thought. Exactly as one might expect. Rafar knows no frontal attack will work. He's trying his evil hand at subtlety, at moral compromise.
And succeeding, I say.
Yes, I agree.
But what can we do? If Hogan loses his family, he'll be destroyed.
No, not destroyed. Knocked down, perhaps. Decimated, perhaps. But it's all because of the dross in his own soul which the Spirit of God has yet to convict him of. We can do nothing but wait and let all things take their course. Nathan could only shake his head in frustration. Gilo stood nearby, pondering Tal's words. Of course what Tal said was true. Men will sin if men will.
"Captain," Gilo said, "what if Hogan falls?"
Tal leaned back against the dank metal wall and said, "We can't be concerned with the question of if. The question we must deal with is when. Both Hogan and Bush are now laying the foundation we need for this battle. Once that's done, Hogan as well as Bush must fall. Only their clear defeat will coax the strong man out of hiding." Gilo and Nathan both looked at Tal with consternation.
You would sacrifice these men?" Nathan asked.
"Only for a season," Tal answered.
Marshall brought out Ernie Johnson's large packet of pirated records from the Whitmore College accounting office and handed them across the Clarion's reception counter to Harvey Cole. Cole was a CPA Marshall knew well enough to trust.
"I don't know what you'll be able to make of all this," said Marshall. "But see if you can find out whatever Johnson found, and see if it looks crooked."
"Wow," said Harvey. "This is going to cost you."
"I'll swap you some free advertising. How about that?"
Harvey smiled.
"Sounds fine.
Okay, I'll get to it. Get back to you."
ASAP.
Harvey went out the door, and Marshall returned to his office, rejoining Bernice in their evening after-hours project. They were working amid a flurry of notes, papers, phone books, and any other public records they could get their hands on. In the middle of it all, a consolidated list of names, addresses, jobs, and tax records was forming, piece by piece. Marshall looked over his notes from his interview with Harmel.
"Okay, what about that judge? What's his name? Jefferson?"
"Anthony C.," Bernice replied, flipping through last year's phone book. "Yeah, Anthony C. Jefferson, 221 Alder Street." She immediately went to her scrawled notes from the top of the town realty. 221 Alder. Her eyes scanned one sheet in her notebook, then another, until finally, bingo!
Another one.
"So check me out on this. Jefferson was bumped by the network, and Omni came in and bought his house." Marshall scribbled some reminder notes to himself on a yellow legal pad.
"I'd like to know why Jefferson moved and how much he sold that house for. I'd also like to know who's living there now."
Bernice shrugged. "We'll just have to go down the list and check all these network people's addresses. I'll lay you odds it's one of them."
"What about Baker, the judge who replaced Jefferson?"
Bernice looked at another list. "No, Baker's over in the house that used to belong to the high school principal, Waller, George Waller."
"Oh, yeah, he's the one who lost his house in the sheriff's sale."
"Oh, there are a lot of those. And I'll bet we might find more if we knew where to look."
"We'll have to snoop around the county finance office. Somehow, some way, those people's property taxes never got to where they were supposed to go. I can't believe this many people would be delinquent on their taxes."
"Someone diverted the money so the taxes were never paid. It's dirty, Hogan. Just plain dirty."
"It wasn't Lou Gregory, the old controller. Look at this. He had to resign because of some conflict of interest rap. Now Irving Pierce is in, and he's Omni-owned, right?"
"You got it."
"And what was that you had on Mayor Steen?"
Bernice consulted her notes, but shook her head. "He just recently bought his house. The deal looks legitimate, except for the previous owner being the former police chief, who left town for no apparent reason. It might mean something. It might not. It's what happened to all those other people that has me wondering."
"Yeah, and why none of them ever squawked or made a fuss about it. Hey, I wouldn't let the county just come in and auction off my house right out from under me, not without asking at least a few questions. There's something else about this that we don't know."
"Well, think about the Carlucci's. Did you know their house sold to Omni for $5,000? That's ridiculous."
"And the Carlucci's went poof. Gone, just like that."
"So I wonder who's living in their house now."
"Maybe the new high school principal, or the new fire marshal, or a new city councilman, or new this, or a new that."
"Or one of the new college regents." Marshall scrambled for some more papers.
"Boy, what a mess."
He finally found the list he was looking for.
"Let's go through those regents and see what we come up with."
Bernice flipped through a few pages in her notebook. "I know for sure that Pinkston's place is owned by Omni. Some kind of trust arrangement."
"What about Eugene Baylor?"
"Don't you have that somewhere?"
"One of us does, but now I can't remember who."
They both fumbled through their notes, papers, lists. Marshall finally found it among his scattered leaves.
"Here it is. Eugene Baylor, 1024 Southwest 147th.
"Oh, I think I saw that here somewhere." Bernice perused her notes. "Yes, Omni owns that, too."
"Sheesh. Deeding everything over to Omni Corporation must be a requirement for membership."
"Well, that makes Young and Brumell card-carrying members.
It makes sense, though. If they all want to meld into one universal mind, they have to do away with individuality, and that means no private ownership.
One by one, Marshall read off the names of the college regents, and Bernice researched their addresses. Of the 12 regents, 8 were living in homes owned by Omni Corporation. The others rented apartments. One of the apartment buildings was owned by Omni. Bernice had no information on the other apartment buildings.
"I think we've ruled out coincidence," said Marshall.
"And now I can't wait to hear what your friend Lemley has to say."
"Sure, that Kasif and Omni Corporation are linked. That's obvious."
Marshall took just a moment to ponder.
"But do you know what really scares me? So far, everything we see here is legal. I'm sure they've been crooked somewhere to get where they are, but you can see they're working within the system, or at least doing a very good job of looking like it."
"But come on, Marshall. He's taking over a whole town, for crying out loud."
"And he's doing it legally. Don't forget that."
"But he must leave some tracks somewhere. We've been able to sniff him out at least this far."
Marshall took a deep breath and then sighed it out.
"Well, we can try to track down every person who sold out and left town. Try to find out why it happened. We can check into what positions they held before they left and who holds that position now. Whoever holds the position now can be asked what connection he or she has with Omni Corporation or with his Universal Consciousness mind-tripping group. We can ask each and every one of them what they might know about the elusive Mr. Kasif. We can do some more research on the Omni Corporation itself, find out where it's based, what it deals in, what else it owns. We have our work cut out for us. And then I guess it'll be time to go directly to our friends with what we know and get a response from them."
Bernice could feel something coming across in Marshall's manner.
"What's bothering you, Marshall?"
Marshall tossed his notes on the desk and leaned back in his chair to ponder.
"Bernie, we'd be fools to think we're immune to any of this."
Bernice gave a resigned nod.
"Yeah, I've been wondering about it, wondering what they might try."
"I think they already have my daughter."
It was a blunt statement. Marshall himself was shocked at the sound of it.
"You don't know that for sure."
"If I don't know that, I don't know anything."
"But what kind of real power could they wield, except economic and political? I don't buy all this cosmic spiritual stuff. It's nothing but a mind trip."
"That's easy for you to say. You're not religious."
"You'll find it's a lot easier."
"So, what if we end up like Harmel, no family left, just hiding in the bushes and talking about spooks?"
"I wouldn't mind ending up like Strawn. He seems comfortable enough just being out of this whole thing."
"Well, Bernie, even so, we'd better see it coming before it gets here."
He grabbed her hand in earnest and said to her,
"I hope we both know what we're getting ourselves into. We may be in too deep already. We could quit, I suppose."
"You know we can't do that."
"I know I can't. I'm not putting any expectations on you. You can get out now, go somewhere else, work for some ladies' journal or something. I won't mind."
She smiled at him and held his hand tightly.
"Die all, die merrily."
Marshall only shook his head and smiled in return. Chapter 22. In another state, in a low-income section of another town, a little panel truck weaved its way down a kid-cluttered street through a housing project. All the little duplexes, except for different color schemes, came from the same mold. As the truck pulled to a stop at the end of an aging asphalt cul-de-sac, Princess Cleaners could be seen printed on its side. The driver, a young lady in blue overalls, her hair in a red scarf, got out. She opened the side door and pulled out a large laundry bundle with some bag-draped dresses on hangers. Rechecking the address, she made her way up one walk to one particular door and rang the bell. First the curtain of the front window pulled to the side for a moment, and then there were footsteps toward the door. The door opened.
"Hi, got some cleaning here," said the young lady.
"Oh, yes," said the man who answered the door. "Just bring it in."
He opened the door wider so she could make her way into the house, as three children tried to keep out of her path despite their great curiosity. The man called to his wife,
"Honey, the cleaning lady is here."
She came in from the small kitchen looking tense and nervous. "You children go outside and play," she ordered. They whined a bit, but she herded them out the door, closed it, then drew shut the one window that still remained open.
"Where'd you get all this laundry?" the man asked.
"It was in the truck. I don't know who it belongs to." The man, a heavy-set Italian with gray and curly hair, offered his hand.
"Joe Carlucci."
The young lady set down the laundry and shook his hand.
"Bernice Krueger from the Clarion."
He showed her to a chair and then said, "They told me I was never to talk to you or Mr. Hogan."
"For the sake of our children," they said, Mrs. Carlucci added. "This is Angelina. It was for her sake, for the children's sake, that we moved away. We left it all. We said nothing."
"Can you help us?" asked Angelina. Bernice got her pad ready.
"Okay, just take your time. We'll start at the beginning."
At what Al Lemley called the halfway point between Ashton and New York, Marshall pulled the Buick into the parking lot of a little insurance office in Taylor, a small town at the crossing of two major highways with no other real reason for being there. He stepped into the little office and was immediately recognized by the lady at the desk.
"Mr. Hogan?" she asked.
"Yes, good morning."
"Mr. Lemley is already here. He's waiting for you."
She showed him to another door, which led to a back office that no one was using at the time.
"Now there's coffee out here on the counter, and the bathroom is right through this door and to the right."
"Thank you."
"You're welcome."
Marshall closed the door, and only then did Al Lemley stand up and give him a warm handshake.
"Marshall," he said, "it's great to see you. Just great."
He was a smaller man, bald, with a hooked nose and sharp blue eyes. He had spunk and sparkle. And Marshall had always known him as a priceless associate, a friend who could come through with almost any much-needed favor. Al sat behind the desk, and Marshall pulled a chair up beside him so they could both look over the materials Al had brought. For a little while, they talked old times. Al was pretty much filling the vacancy that Marshall had left in the city room at the Times, and he was beginning to have a real appreciation for Marshall's ability to handle the job.
"But I don't want to trade places with you, buddy," he said. "I thought you moved to Ashton to get away from it all." "I guess it followed me there," he said.
"In a few weeks, New York may be a lot safer."
"What have you got?"
Al pulled an 8x10 glossy photo from a file folder and let it slide across the desk under Marshall's nose.
"Is this your boy?"
Marshall looked at the picture. He'd never seen Alexander M. Kasif before, but from all the descriptions he knew,
this has to be him. "Oh, it's him, all right. He's known, and then he's not known, if you catch my drift. General public never heard of the guy, but start asking investors on Wall Street or government people or foreign diplomats or anyone else in any way connected with international wheeling and dealing and politics, and you'll get a response. He is the president of Omni Corporation. Yes, they are definitely connected."
"Surprise, surprise. So what do you know about Omni Corporation?"
Al shoved a stack of materials toward Marshall, a stack several inches thick.
"Thank goodness for computers. Omni was just a little non-typical in tracking down. They have no central headquarters, no main address. They're scattered into local offices all over the world and keep a very low profile. From what I understand, Kasif keeps his own immediate staff with him and likes to be as invisible as possible, running the whole operation from no one knows where. It's weirdly subterranean. They're not on the New York or American stock exchanges, not by their name at least. The stocks are all diversified among, maybe 100 different front corporations. Omni is the owner and controller of retail chain stores, banks, mortgage companies, fast food chains, soft drink bottlers, you name it."
Al continued talking as he thumbed through the stack of materials.
"I had some of my staff digging into this stuff. Omni doesn't come right out and print anything about itself. First you have to find out what the front corporation is, then you sort of sneak in the back door and find out what interest the big mother company has in it. Take this one here."
Al produced a stockholder's annual report from an Idaho mining company.
"You don't know what you're really reading about until you get down here to the end. See? A subsidiary of Omni International.
International.
Very international. You wouldn't believe how influential they are in Arab oil, the common market, the World Bank, international terrorism.
What?
Don't expect to find any stockholders' reports on the latest car bombing or mass murder, but for every documented above-board item here, there are a couple hundred pieces of under-the-table scuttlebutt that no one can prove, but everyone seems to know.
And such is life.
And such is your man, Kasif. I want to tell you, Marshal, he knows how to spill blood if he has to, and sometimes when he doesn't have to. I'd say this guy is a perfect cross between the ultimate guru and Adolf Hitler, and he makes Al Capone look like a Boy Scout. Word has it that even the Mafia is afraid of him.
Angelina Carlucci tended to spill words more from emotions than from objective recall, which made her story travel in agonizing circles. Bernice had to keep asking questions to get things clear.
Getting back to your son, Carl,
they broke his hands, she wept.
Who broke his hands?
Joe intervened to help his wife.
It was after we said we would not sell the store.
They'd asked us.
Well, they didn't ask. They told us we'd better...
But they talked to us about it a few times, and we wouldn't sell.
And that's when they started threatening you?
They never threaten,
Angelina said angrily.
They say they never threatened us.
Joe tried to explain.
They threaten you without sounding like they are. It's hard to explain. But they talk the deal over with you, and they let you know how wise you will be to go along with the deal. And, you know, you just know that you should go along with it if you don't want anything evil to befall you.
So, just who was it that you talked to?
Two gentlemen who were... Well, they said they were friends of the new people who own the store now. I just thought at first that they were realtors or something. I had no idea.
Bernice looked over her notes again.
All right, so it was after you turned them down the third time that Carl had his hands broken.
Yes, at school.
Well, who did it?
Angelina and Joe looked at each other. Angelina answered,
No one saw it. It was during recess at school, and no one saw it.
Carl must have seen it.
Joe only shook his head and waved his hand at Bernice to stop short.
You cannot test Carl about it. He is still tormented. He has bad dreams.
Angelina leaned forward and whispered,
Evil spirits, Miss Kruger. Carl thinks it was evil spirits.
Bernice kept waiting for these two responsible adults to explain the strange perceptions of their young son. She had trouble phrasing a question.
Well, surely you must know what really happened, or at least have some idea.
The two of them only stared at each other blankly at a loss for words.
There were no teachers on the grounds who assisted him after it happened?
Joe tried to explain.
He was playing baseball with some other boys. The ball rolled into the woods, and he went after it. When he came back, he was crazy, screaming. He'd wet himself. His hands were broken.
And he never said who did it?
Joe Carlucci's eyes were glazed with terror. He whispered,
Big black things.
Men?
Things. Carla says they were spirits, monsters.
Don't knock it, Bernice told herself. It was clear these poor, deluded people really believed something of this nature was attacking them. They were very devout Catholics, but also very superstitious. Perhaps that explained the many crucifixes on every door, the pictures of Jesus, and the figurines of the Virgin Mary everywhere, on every table, over every doorway, in every window. Marshall had perused the materials on the Omni Corporation. He still hadn't read about one thing.
What about any kind of religious affiliation?
Yeah, said Al, reaching for another folder. You were right on that.
Omni's just one of several underwriters for the Universal Consciousness Society. And that's a whole other ball of financial and political wax, and perhaps the main motivation behind the company, even more than money. Omni owns, or backs, oh, brother, there must be hundreds of them, society-owned businesses, from cottage-level enterprises clear up to banks, retail stores, schools, colleges. Colleges? Yeah, and law firms, too, according to this news clipping. They have a major lobbying task force in Washington, and they've been regularly pushing their own special interest legislation. It's usually anti-Jewish and anti-Christian, if that's of any interest to you. How about towns? Does this society like to buy towns? I know Kasich's done it, or other things similar to that. Listen, I got in touch with Chuck Anderson, one of our foreign correspondents, and he's heard all kinds of interesting things besides seeing a lot of it himself. It seems these universal consciousness people are a worldwide club. We've located society chapters in 93 different countries. They just seem to pop up everywhere, no matter what part of the world. And yes, they have acquired full control of towns, villages, hospitals, some ships, some corporations. Sometimes they buy their way in, sometimes they vote their way in, sometimes they just crowd their way in. Like an invasion without guns. Yes, usually quite legally, but that's probably out of sheer cleverness, not any integrity. And remember, you're also looking at a lot of power and pull here. You're standing right in the path of Big Daddy himself, and from what I gather, he doesn't slow, stop, or even go around. Nuts. I'd cool it, buddy. Call the feds. Let somebody bigger handle it if they want. You still have a job back at the Times if you ever want it. At least cover the story from a distance. You're a Class A reporter, but you're too close. You have too much to lose. All Marshall could think was, why me? Bernice had stumbled too far into a touchy situation. The Carluccis were getting more unsettled and terrified the more she questioned them. Maybe this wasn't a good idea, Joe finally said. If they ever find out we talked to you... Bernice was about to scream as she heard that word again. Joe, who do you mean by they? You keep saying they and them, but you never say who.
I can't tell you, he said with great difficulty.
Well, let me at least clear this much up. Are they people? I mean, real people? He and Angelina thought for a moment, then he answered,
Yes, they are real people.
So they are real flesh and blood people.
And maybe spirits, too.
I'm talking about the real people now, Bernice insisted. Was it real people who audited your taxes? Reluctantly, they nodded. And was it a real flesh and blood man who posted the auction notice on your door?
We didn't see him, Angelina said.
But it was a real piece of paper, right?
But nobody told us it would happen, Joe protested. We always paid our taxes. I have the canceled checks to prove it. The people at the county office wouldn't listen to us.
Angelina was angry now.
We had no money to pay the taxes they wanted. We already paid them. We couldn't pay them again. They said they would take our store, take all our inventory, and business was bad, very bad. Half our customers left and wouldn't come in anymore. And I know what kept them away, said Angelina defiantly. We could all feel it. I tell you, windows don't break by themselves, and groceries don't fly off the shelves by themselves. It was the devil himself in our store.
Bernice had to reassure them. All right. I'm not arguing with that. You saw what you saw. I don't doubt you.
But don't you see, Miss Kruger? Joe asked with tears in his eyes. We knew we could not stay. What would they do next? Our store was failing. Our home was sold out from under us. Our children were being tormented by evil people, spirits, whatever. We knew it would be best not to fight. It was God's will. We sold the store. They gave us a good price.
Bernice knew that wasn't so. You didn't get half of what that store was worth. Joe broke down and cried as he said,
But we are free. We are free.
Bernice had to wonder. Then came the Blitz, a die-all-die merrily push for information accompanied by mixed feelings of determination and foreboding, by conflicts between initial impulses and second thoughts. Every Tuesday and Friday for 2 weeks, the Ashton Clarion still appeared on the newsstands and in all the mailboxes of subscribers. But its editor and chief reporter were very hard to contact, or even catch a glimpse of. Marshall's phone messages stacked up unreturned. Bernice was simply never home. There were several nights when Marshall never went home at all, but slept here and there, now and then in the office, waiting for special calls, making other calls, working at keeping the paper afloat with one hand while going over lists of contacts, tax records, business reports, interviews, and leads with the other. The people who had left their positions, and usually Ashton, and the people who replaced them were definitely two separate groups of widely different persuasions. After a while, Marshall and Bernice could just about predict what their responses were going to be. Bernice called Adam Jared, the college regent whose daughter was allegedly molested by Ted Harmel.
"No," said Jared, "I really don't know anything about any special, what did you call it?"
"A society, the Universal Consciousness Society."
"No, afraid not."
Marshall spoke with Eugene Baylor.
"Now," Baylor replied somewhat impatiently, "I've never even heard the name Kasif, and I really don't understand what you're driving at."
"I'm trying to chase down some claims that the college might be negotiating a sale of its property with Alexander Kasif of the Omni Corporation."
Baylor laughed and said, "You must have heard about another college. There's nothing like that happening here."
"And what about the information we've received that the college is in heavy financial trouble?"
Baylor didn't like that question at all. "Listen, the last editor of the Clarion tried that one, too, and it was the dumbest move he ever made. Why don't you just run your paper and leave the running of the college to us?"
The former regents had a different tune. Morris James, now a business consultant in Chicago, had nothing but bad memories of his last year with the college.
"They really taught me what it must be like to be a leper," he told Bernice. "I felt I could be a good voice on the board, you know, a stabilizing factor, but they simply would tolerate no dissent. I thought it was highly unprofessional."
Bernice asked him, "And what about Eugene Baylor's handling of the college finances?"
"Well, I left before any of this really serious trouble arose, this trouble you've described to me, but I could foresee it. I did try to block some decisions the board made regarding the granting of special powers and privileges to Baylor. I thought it was giving too much unauthorized control to one man, without the oversight of the other regents. Needless to say, my opinion was very unpopular."
Bernice asked a very pointed question.
"Mr. James, what finally precipitated your resigning from the board and leaving Ashton?"
"Well, that's a tough one to answer," he began reluctantly.
His answer took about 15 minutes, but the bottom line came down to, "My wholesale business was so harassed and so sabotaged by unseen mobsters, I guess I would call it,
that I became too great an insurance risk. I couldn't fill my orders. Clientele dropped way off, and I just couldn't stay above water anymore. The business folded. I took the hint, and I got out of there. I've been doing fine ever since. You can't keep a good man down, you know."
Marshall managed to track down Rita Jacobson, now living in New Orleans. She was not happy to hear from someone in Ashton.
"Let the devil have that town," she said bitterly. "If he wants it so bad, let him have it."
Marshall asked her about Julene Langstrat.
"She's a witch. I mean a real, live witch."
He asked her about Alexander Kasif.
"A warlock and a gangster rolled into one. Stay out of his way. He'll bury you before you even feel it."
He tried to ask her some other questions, but she finally said, "Please don't ever call this number again," and hung up. Marshall tracked down as many former members of the city council as he could by telephone, and found out that one had simply retired, but all the others stepped down because of some form of hardship. Alan Bates fell ill of cancer, Shirley Davidson went through a divorce and ran off with a new lover, Carl Fromm was set up, as he called it, with a phony tax scam, Jules Bennington's business